Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It is Friday, July 9th, 2021. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew, and I hope you and your family enjoyed the Independence Day holiday.
Hey there, Chris, and we had a lovely holiday. Thank you.
Well, indeed, Ed, so did I. And with half of 2021 already gone, the headline for trade books remains as it's been for over a year when the pandemic first struck. Surprisingly strong unit sales continue.
Yeah, and the really great news is that we're comparing now week-over-week sales to the really strong sales we had in 2020, right? In other words, in the weeks after the COVID dip ended and sales began their ascent to what would turn out to be one of the strongest annual performances for trade publishing in decades in 2020. Just before the July 4th holiday, we reported that print book sales had risen about 6.4% in the week ended June 26, this over the comparable week in 2020, from outlets reporting to NPD BookScan. And again, these are especially promising numbers given where sales were in June of 2020. So a few points to make, and that is that adult fiction sales continue to shine this years after declining fiction sales. But nonfiction sales are starting to show signs of decline, which I think is to be expected, I suppose, after last summer's bumper crop of Trump books, including John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened and Marielle Trump's memoir. But definitely something to keep an eye on for sure, because political books really paced sales in 2020, even though fiction books have ticked up as well.
And a decline in nonfiction books, Andrew, would not be the only challenge facing publishers in the second half of this year. This week, PW reported on a book industry study group webinar that took stock of the supply chain and found some weak links.
Yeah, so the economic news has mostly been good, but our listeners no doubt have heard about the challenges facing the post-COVID economy. And while the supply chain obviously held up pretty well for publishers in 2020, I mean, we just talked about how strong sales are, challenges now loom, from truck driver shortages to widespread port congestion and, you know, skyrocketing container costs, challenges that publishers say face the book industry supply chain for the rest of this year and likely into 2022. You can read all about this on the PW site. We have a report on the BSG webinar from this week, and I'll spare you all the details here. And I'll just say that all three speakers who spoke at the webinar noted that it's important for publishers to recognize what is happening, not just in the book business, but across the broader economy, and to make adjustments to their supply chains, including things like doing more domestic digital printing, for example, which, given the escalating costs of shipping and freight, could shorten their supply chains and allow them to ship directly to customers from the manufacturer. Anyway, lots of great insight from this webinar, and you can check out the piece and link to the webinar from the PW site.
Also this week, a class action lawsuit accusing Amazon and the Big Five publishers of ebook price fixing is back in the news. Defendants in the case have told the judge that the suit is, and I quote, implausible.
Yeah. So in a letter to the court this week, lawyers for defendants Amazon and the Big Five publishers told Magistrate Judge Deborah Friedman that they are going to file a motion seeking to stay all discovery in this lawsuit, which, of course, alleges a conspiracy to fix ebook prices. But they want the discovery stayed until after the court has had a chance to rule on their motion to dismiss the case. And in the letter, lawyers for the publishers and for Amazon argue that doing discovery now would place a substantial burden on them, while the facts of the case suggest that, you know, it's without merit, totally without merit, they say, and will be dismissed. At the same time, in what's known as a Rule 26F filing this week, lawyers for a potential class of consumers, led by Seattle-based firm Higgins Berman, rejected the publisher's request for a delay and instead proposed what they called a deferred discovery plan that would put off some things or lengthen the timeframe for some discovery while also setting out a discrete discovery agenda that would, you know, begin with production of things like contracts and documents that were produced to other states and government agencies investigating the ebook industry and, of course, ebook sales data. But the news here really is in the 8-page filing by Amazon and the publishers and their claim that they have substantial grounds for dismissal of this case. In short, the defendants say out loud in this filing what we've been saying all along, and that's that there doesn't seem to be any evidence supporting a horizontal conspiracy under Section 1 of the Sherman Act or any facts supporting a conspiracy to monopolize under Section 2 of the Sherman Act, or any evidence that Amazon unilaterally set out to violate the Sherman Act. In fact, the publishers say there's no evidence of communication between the publishers. There's no evidence of how this alleged agreement or scheme or conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, was entered into, or anything that would even suggest an overarching conspiracy to fix ebook prices. And what really caught my eye is the idea that, you know, as you say, the publishers say that their conspiracy is implausible. Attorneys point out that the contract provisions at issue in this case were actually struck in 2014 and 2015. And, you know, that's important because at that time, all of these contracts were reviewed by the DOJ and the state's attorney general because of an order in the Apple price fixing case. And I'll quote the defense brief here. It is implausible that the publishers would conspire to enter into anti-competitive agreements with Amazon while under the supervision of antitrust authorities, and implausible that the publishers would actually conspire with Amazon to help it become a monopolist when just years before they were alleged to have conspired against Amazon to reduce its market share.
What do you make of the publisher's motion for a dismissal, Andrew? Are they likely to succeed?
You know, I'll try to be brief here, but it's hard. It always is with these cases. But I'll just remind our listeners that this suit specifically alleges that Amazon and the publishers' use of various MFN clauses, most favored nation clauses in their contracts, is evidence of some agreement somewhere to prevent competitive pricing, and that this causes consumers to overpay when they purchase ebooks. And while the publishers and Amazon point back to the Apple case as evidence of why such a conspiracy here makes no sense, the plaintiffs in the case say the Apple case is exactly why this case needs to go forward and should enter discovery without delay, because there is a history of price fixing here among the Big Five publishers. In the Apple case, of course, the Big Five were motivated by their desire to control ebook prices, this according to the plaintiff lawyers. And while the facts may be totally different here, the same motivations apply, they say. You know, the Big Five want to control ebook prices and keep them high, and Amazon, like Apple did back in the day, just doesn't want to compete. Now, I agree with the publishers here. The theory of this case on its face just doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense that the publishers would want to work with Amazon on some kind of price-fixing conspiracy. But as I reported earlier this year, apparently you can still be part of a price-fixing conspiracy, even if you were sort of forced into it or coerced into it. So I can't say whether the publisher's argument that they had no desire to help Amazon, which I'm sure is the case, I can't say whether that's going to be enough to win the day here. And when you factor in that there are investigations underway in state legislatures, apparently, and that the pricing in play here for ebooks on its face looks bad. And of course, there is, as the plaintiffs know, a history of price fixing here. Well, I don't know that there is enough here to forestall discovery. But, you know, this much we do know. Publishers and Amazon are arguing that they are likely to get the case dismissed, but it is a low bar to keep a case from getting dismissed. And given everything we know about Amazon and the publishers and past price fixing and consolidation in the industry and our newfound scrutiny of antitrust and of Amazon, I don't know that it's likely that this case just gets tossed. And I'll say this too. Maybe the case doesn't make a ton of sense, but the Apple case seemed absurd at the time too. And then we got to read all the emails and hear all the evidence. And suddenly, yeah, you could just see what the problem was. So how this goes, I really don't know. We're just going to have to keep an eye on it and wait and see.
And while this program took a break for the 4th of July, the Supreme Court ended the term by declining to hear an appeal of a 5-year-old libel suit brought against Simon & Schuster and author Guy Lawson. Two conservative justices, however, wrote eye-opening dissents.
Simon & Schuster this week, yeah, they applauded the Supreme Court's decision not to take up this case, which sought to challenge a key protection for authors and journalists. But as you say, Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch used their dissents to sort of lash out at the current media landscape and suggested that the legal standard at issue in this case, which was established in the landmark civil rights era case New York Times versus Sullivan, should be revisited. But I'll back up for a second and we'll talk about the case. You know, it involves Guy Lawson's 2015 book, Arms and the Dudes, how three stoners from Miami Beach became the most unlikely gun runners in history. And, you know, our listeners may recognize this. It was the basis for the movie War Dogs. Well, back in 2017, Shkelzen Berisha, who is the son of the former prime minister of Albania, sued Lawson and Simon & Schuster, arguing that the book's portrayal of his involvement in corrupt arms deals was defamatory. But in December of 2018, the district judge dismissed the suit, holding that Berisha, as a limited public figure, failed to show actual malice. In other words, by the standard that was set in the Supreme Court's unanimous 1964 decision in New York Times versus Sullivan, Berisha, as a public figure, failed to show that Lawson and Simon & Schuster had, and here's the standard, published statements they knew to be false or with reckless disregard as to whether or not they were false. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously affirmed the decision in September of last year. And now, with the Supreme Court's denial of certiorari, in other words, the Supreme Court's denial to take up the case, case is over. In a brief statement, Simon & Schuster officials said they were gratified by the decision and said it affirmed long-held rights and protections for authors and journalists under the First Amendment, and I'll quote them here, puts an end to a lawsuit that never should have been brought in the first place. But the takeaway that I have from this case, and that many other observers have too, is that apparently two of the court's conservative justices believe there should actually be more cases like Berisha's. And in their dissents, which take aim more at the fractured media landscape today than the merits of the case, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch question just how well the standard that was articulated by the Supreme Court in 1964 in the Sullivan case hold up today. And I'm going to pull out a little bit of Gorsuch's dissent here and quote him. He writes, "What started in 1964 with the decision to tolerate the occasional falsehood to ensure robust reporting by a comparative handful of print and broadcast outlets has now evolved into an ironclad subsidy for the publication of falsehoods by means and on a scale previously unimaginable." He goes on to write that if ensuring an informed democratic debate is the goal, how well do we serve that interest with rules that no longer merely tolerate, but encourage falsehoods in quantities that no one could have envisioned almost 60 years ago? Now, that is a worthy critique of the media, but I struggle to see its relevance here. And frankly, I found both dissents, and especially Clarence Thomas's dissents, to be quite maddening.
And as you noted in your PW reporting, justices have voiced concerns in the past over whether the malice libel standard articulated in Times v. Sullivan remains appropriate. So what's your take on these latest dissents?
Well, my take is that, of course, a lot has changed since 1964, no question. But the Sullivan standard very clearly still functions as a pillar of the American free press, no question about that. Now, listeners surely know this, but before the Sullivan decision, public officials in southern states effectively had used the threat of libel and defamation actions against news organizations to suppress coverage of the civil rights movement. And the actual malice standard for libel and defamation that was adopted by the Supreme Court effectively mitigated the risk from costly defamation claims, and it still protects reporters today. Now, today, with these dissents, Thomas and Gorsuch profess to be concerned about the lack of accountability among media organizations. But what they are really referring to, for the most part, it seems to me, are user-generated comments on social media sites and how they get amplified on social media sites and across the internet, you know, things like false stories and conspiracy theories, which take on a life of their own. And here's where Clarence Thomas's dissent is particularly questionable, because in it, he raises the Pizzagate conspiracy theory as an example. Now, our listeners will remember that that story, the Pizzagate story, was about the Democrats and Hillary Clinton who were running some sort of satanic child sex ring out of the basement of a DC area pizzeria that didn't have a basement. But that conspiracy theory, I'll note, was driven entirely on social media. It wasn't on the media. It wasn't through reporting and through organizations, right? And that case wasn't about pizza. It was about politics. Thomas doesn't even count Hillary Clinton as a victim of that conspiracy. In his dissent, he notes that the victim was the person who actually showed up, who believed the conspiracy theory, and actually showed up and opened fire in the pizza parlor because he believed the story. But this is a case about libel, right? Ostensibly, this dissent is in a libel case. There's defamation, but there's no defamation, and there's no libel injury to the shooter that went to the pizzeria. So how does this critique tie to the Sullivan standard? It was just a puzzling note in Clarence Thomas's dissent. I mean, I'd say that there's a real test going on in the courts today, and that's the voting machine company Dominion, who is suing Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Fox News and One America, I think, over their claims, the repeated claims and amplified claims over those networks of the stolen election. So we'll see what happens there. But I think what really gets me about these dissents is that they really are just attacks on the media landscape without really pointing to the body that really needs to step in and fix it, which is, of course, Congress. And Gorsuch even admits that. You know, he writes at the end, "I do not profess any sure answers." I'm going to quote him again here. "I'm not even sure of all the questions we should be asking. But given the momentous changes in the nation's media landscape since 1964, I cannot help but think that the court would profit from returning its attention, whether in this case or another, to a field so vital to the safe deposit of our liberties." You know, if you replace the courts with Congress there, then it makes sense to me, and I'm all for it. But there's nothing really the court can do here to fix the media landscape. And the idea that more libel cases in this environment will bring accountability, when what it will really do is chill free speech and publication, I just think that's a frightening prospect. You know, again, Gorsuch describes the symptoms of the problems we face, and he does it pretty well. But to me, these dissents are the legal equivalent of, you know, smacking your TV or turning your computer on and off, right? It's sort of like a visceral, easy solution to something that's not based in any real understanding of the underlying problem. And that I find alarming. No question our media landscape today is rife with fake news and dangerous lies. But the Sullivan standard, I would argue, is not the root cause of that. And letting this court open the hood on press freedom to tinker around, something we should be concerned about. Simon Schuster was right to applaud this decision, and I would hope that the Authors Guild and the AAP would at least acknowledge this as well.
And Rob Bonice, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, from entrepreneurs to entertainers, the ironclad rule for business achievement has long been faking it until you're making it. In a new book that is part memoir and part business playbook, Sabrina Horn turns the adage upside down. Make it, don't fake it, she counsels us. A guide to authenticity in communications, Horn's book lays out the spectrum of lies, from useful and harmless to gaslighting, then builds a case for getting your story straight and sticking to it.
You cannot build a sustainable anything, a sustainable business or relationship, a marriage, based on lies, right? You have to have a basis for integrity and the truth. The issue is that, right, the truth builds trust, and trust is the essence of every enduring brand. If you tell the truth, you learn to trust it, and you deliver a consistent customer experience. You break that trust when you either veer from your core values, or you slipped up and maybe you weren't telling exactly the truth or left some facts out, right? And so core values are the basis for everything, for your culture, how you treat your people, your business processes, how you treat your customers, and all of that radiates out through your brand. It is essential.
Make it, don't fake it. Next on this CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.